From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with one of the foremost tenor saxophonists in modern jazz, Stan Getz. And we'll talk with a photographer who documented the jazz scene of the 1930s and 40s. You've probably seen William Gottlieb's pictures on record jackets and book covers. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a newly released recording of Pierre Boulez conducting Mahler's Fifth Symphony. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dick Tracy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Romania's interior minister has been dismissed after government criticism of the police for failing to maintain order yesterday during clashes with demonstrators. The ousted minister has been replaced with a military judge, and the demonstrations are being suppressed by steel workers and miners who support the government. The BBC's Owen Bennett Jones reports from Bucharest.
In a sign that the government might be trying to compromise with its opponents, the new interior minister has said that he wants to open a dialogue with the demonstrators. This is in marked contrast to a government statement earlier today, which said that it was impossible to hold a dialogue with irrational and violent people. The streets of Bucharest are filled with government supporters. The miners, some of whom now have axes, came to Bucharest from the Yew Valley in response to an appeal from Mr. Iliescu, and they are occupying University Square. Some 500 steelworkers from Galatz are guarding all the entrances to Victory Square. In both places, they spent the day brutally beating up people who they suspected of opposing the government. They use clubs to beat their victims into submission before dragging them away.
Owen Bennett Jones in Bucharest. Canada is urging the United States not to break off contact with the Palestine Liberation Organization. External Affairs Minister Joe Clark said today that he's written to Secretary of State Baker, urging him to maintain contacts with the PLO despite tensions over an aborted raid on an Israeli beach resort last month. Israel's new government has been pressing for an end to contacts with the PLO following the attack. Like the U.S., Canada upgraded its contacts with the PLO in 1988 after Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat renounced terrorism. Israeli Army Radio decided to take Secretary of State Baker up on his invitation yesterday for Israel to call the U.S. when it's serious about peace. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Baker was criticizing Israel in the House Foreign Affairs Committee yesterday. He recited the White House telephone number. "When you're serious about peace, call us," he said sarcastically. Today, Israeli Army Radio did just that. They called the White House number and asked to speak to Baker. The switchboard operator said that Baker was at the State Department and offered that number. "But Baker told us to call him here," the reporter said. The operator was mildly annoyed, gave the State Department number, and hung up. The entire call was broadcast on Army Radio, the only radio station operating today because of a 24-hour workers' strike. The State Department today clarified Baker's remarks, saying they were not directed only at Israel and that anyone could use the phone number. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices slipped a bit on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about a point and a half to close at 2,928.22. Volume on the big board was 136 million shares. This is NPR. The Supreme Court ruled today that hospitals and nursing homes can sue in federal court if they don't like the way state-run Medicaid programs reimburse their costs. The 5-4 decision follows a Virginia hospital association to invoke a federal civil rights law in its challenge of Virginia's state Medicaid reimbursement rates. Officials from most of the 50 states had urged the court to rule against the association. They said that the decision could lead to an explosion of lawsuits affecting hundreds of millions of dollars in federal and state funding. House Republicans unveiled a new anti-crime and drug-fighting bill today. Drug Policy Chief William Bennett joined the lawmakers in calling for a restoration of public order. Janice Winborn has details.
Bennett says it looks like the drug control strategy initiated by the Bush administration is having some impact on cocaine trafficking. But no one should be lulled into thinking this is the end of the crime or violence, he said. Now is the time, Bennett said, to turn up the heat.
This is good, strong, positive legislation. It sends a message to the American people that the administration and the Republican Party are committed to fulfilling the president's promise that this scourge will stop.
The law expands drug testing in prisons, jails, and transportation systems, restricts criminal appeals, and increases search and seizure powers for law enforcement. It allows the death penalty in drug cases, even if a death did not occur during the crime, and requires mandatory loss of federal benefits for drug trafficking or possession. I'm Janice Winborn in Washington.
Police in Colombia said today that they've killed the number 5 man in the Medellin cocaine cartel. A police report says that John Arias Tascon was killed during a police operation last night in a wealthy section of Medellin. Arias has been described as the head of the cocaine cartel's paid assassins and a lieutenant of drug boss Pablo Escobar. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tenor saxophonist Stan Getz has enjoyed popularity in both the worlds of jazz and pop. In the 1950s and 60s, he was a perennial poll winner in the jazz magazines. In 1962 and 64, he landed in the top 40 with his bossa nova hits Desafinado and Girl from Ipanema, which started the Brazilian music craze in the United States. Getz has won 11 Grammys during his career. Jazz critic Francis Davis once paraphrased F. Scott Fitzgerald to describe Getz. Davis wrote, "There's something gorgeous about Getz, some heightened sensitivity to life, such as one rarely perceives in jazz." Stan Getz has a new album called Appassionato. This is a composition called Coba. Tell me how you came about doing this new record, Appassionato, and how Herb Alpert ended up producing it. I know he's the head of the record company that it's on.
Well, actually, that's the reason that I ended up doing it and he producing, because I'd never known of his capabilities as a producer. I'd never met the man. All I knew him from was the Tijuana Brass way back.
Mm-hmm.
And when he wanted to sign me to the company, he said, "I want to produce the record, so what do you say?" He owns the company. I said, "Fine." But as we went ahead and did the record, it turned out that he's just one of the most complete persons in a studio you'll ever want to meet. He just, I was amazed watching him work with this record, and I'm glad he produced it. He did a great job.
For the past few years, you've been teaching at Stanford, right?
Yeah.
Kind of musician in residence.
Artist in residence.
Describe your teaching style.
Oh, I don't have a teaching style. I never taught before. I never studied music myself.
Yeah.
All I did was listen to them play and talk with them and play with them, and hoping some of it would rub off. And I did end up with some very fine pupils.
So you never had a music teacher yourself? You never took lessons?
No. I took a few saxophone lessons in the beginning, but that's about all. I went on the road when I was 15, and everything I've learned has been in what you might call the traveling academies.
Yeah, right. Who showed you the most when you were young and on the road?
I think the very first band leader, Jack Teagarden. He was amazing, wonderful musician. And Benny Goodman. And then Woody Herman's band. We had a great band. I was about, 19, 20 years old, and I learned a lot on that band. And ever since then, I've had my own band.
You know, when you were on the road with Teagarden, I think you were 16 years old, and if I have the story straight, you had dropped out of high school, and a truant officer tracked you down on the road with Teagarden's band, and then Teagarden ended up becoming your legal guardian for a while so that you could stay on the road and not go back to high school?
That's right.
How did the truant officer find you?
Oh, I don't know, but I guess I never thought of that. I don't know how he found me. I went to school in New York. He found me in St. Louis. But he found me, and Teagarden had a promise that he would make sure I got my lessons. And I sure did, but I don't know if it's the kind of lessons that the truant officer meant for me to have.
Right. Did Teagarden, was Teagarden reluctant to take you on, you know, him being the guardian, or was he just like pressured into this? Was it a big pain for him?
No, he sort of believed in me and he liked me. And also, don't forget, there was a war going on. I was too young to serve. And it seems that all the good musicians were taken. There was nothing left to choose from but overage, underage, and physically disabled. So I guess he was sort of happy to have me on band and not on the band and not be taken away and put in service.
How did tenor saxophone become your instrument?
Actually, it was alto first, and mm-hmm. before that, harmonica and bass. That's all my father could afford to buy me was a saxophone.
You mean as opposed to a piano or something?
Yeah, I wanted a piano, but he saved up his lunch money for a year when we lived in the Bronx and bought me a little silver turning green alto saxophone. And I got involved with the saxophone, and that was it, I guess.
How did you end up joining Woody Herman's band?
I had left Benny Goodman's band and was out on the coast, and we put together a little three tenor band in the L.A. area, and Woody heard about it. In the band were Zoot Sims and Herbie Stewart and Jimmy Giuffre and myself, and Woody heard about us and hired us en masse to go with the second herd he was forming after he'd disbanded the first.
The saxophone section became known as the Four Brothers.
Correct. Well, it wasn't originally titled The Four Brothers. It was titled The Four Mothers.
Oh, really? Got it.
But we couldn't use it that way at the time, so it became Brothers. But now you could say Four Mothers.
Uh-huh. What was it like for you being in such a great section? You know, I don't know how many bands have such a good horn section.
It was a great band. I mean, it's been one thrill after another in this business with the musicians I've played with and the places I've been. Keeps you young.
Stan Getz is my guest, and he has a new album out on A&M Records called Appassionato. It was in the early 1950s, I think, that you went out on your own, started your own band. Was it a big responsibility when you were younger to have bands on your own and have to worry about, you know, paying the musicians in the bands when you were on gigs and stuff like that?
It was. I was totally unprepared and ill-equipped for it. But because I had a chance to play with whom I wanted to in the rhythm section, in rhythm sections, and to play the music I wanted to exactly as the way I wanted to, it was a great thrill. So the lack of money meant nothing. We just made it somehow, and we kept going on and on.
Let me play one of your early recordings with your own group. This is a 1952 session of Body and Soul. And playing with you is Duke Jordan at the piano, Jimmy Rainey guitar, Bill Crow bass, and Frank Asola drums. This is Body and Soul, recorded in 1952. Body and Soul, my guest Stan Getz on tenor saxophone. Do you have good memories of this session?
Yeah, I do. It was my first session for the Verve label. First time I met Norman Granz, and that started a 20-year relationship with the Verve, which was bought by Polygram, and now they still put it out under the Verve name. I have 80 records on that label, and they're starting to reissue many of them on CD now, and they're doing tremendously well.
Well, let's take a short break, Then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Stan Getz. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Stan Getz is my guest, and he has a new album out called Appassionato. A lot of musicians in the 1950s ended up getting hooked on heroin. And from what I've heard, one of the things I've heard from a lot of musicians is that they saw the musicians they looked up to doing drugs and ended up doing them themselves, and partially in an attempt to emulate their heroes, and also thinking that maybe they'd sound better. And I know you had a drug problem in your teens and in part of your 20s. And I was wondering how you got involved with that.
You know, I think as I look back on it, that musicians use drugs and alcohol for two reasons. It's one of the reasons is the same reason as why doctors have used morphine. Because when you get tired, morphine is a work drug. As long as you don't take too much of it, it'll keep you going. Alcohol is a temporary stimulant before it's a depressant. I think that was one reason, because we traveled and worked very hard, and it was there. I didn't look to any idols as the reason why I would take drugs so it would make me play better. That's nonsense. The other reason is that there's a state of mind that you need to do anything in the art forms. It's called the alpha state. Delta is pure sleep. That's another state, brain waves. And there's delta, there's theta, which is meditation. And alpha is the one state of mind that you do to go into creating something. It's sort of like thinking off the top of your head, relaxed concentration. And when you can't get that naturally, if you're too tired or something, you might resort to alcohol, drugs, to chocolate, to food, anything that will give you a chance to get into alpha, to relax and think, but not really think like, say, an accountant would think, but think in the artistic sense of the word. That's the reason I use stuff.
You ended up in prison for a while. How were you busted?
I had needle marks on my arm, which is a law that since has been declared unconstitutional. It was a misdemeanor, first offense, but it seems that the judge's son had gotten into the same trouble, and he was angry, and he gave me 180 days hard time, first offense on a misdemeanor, and 3 years probation. So all for the best, I think. No pain, no gain in this life.
So you were in prison just for having needle marks?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of prison were you in?
The L.A. holding jail, L.A. County Jail. That's the kind of jail where it's not an institution. It's where people who can't make bail rot in the cell.
Is that what you felt you were doing, is rotting in the cell?
Of course it was. That's what we were all doing. And it was an overcrowded jail.
Did you have to kick in jail?
Yeah.
What did you do when you got out?
What I do, I played and was very happy. I played music 4 days after I got out. After not touching my horn, they took it away in jail. I played a concert at the Shrine Auditorium for 7,000 people.
You were the musician in the 60s most responsible for popularizing Brazilian music in the United States, especially your albums with Wild Gilberto and work with Carlos Jobim. The biggest hit, I think, was Girl from Ipanema. What got you interested in Brazilian music?
The beauty of it.
Had you traveled down there?
Never been to Brazil when I made those records. A lot of people think I'm Brazilian.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm from North Brazil, the Bronx. No, it's just beautiful music with very, very suggestive, laid-back rhythms, and the melodies are beautiful and sad and romantic. It's a folk music. All folk music is beautiful. And it goes perfectly with jazz. So, there you are.
Let me play what was probably your biggest bossa nova hit, The Girl from Ipanema, probably the single record that had the biggest effect on Americans in the 60s in terms of Brazilian music. Stan Getz and his version of Girl from Ipanema. Now, when you ended up on the pop charts, were you surprised?
Oh, was I ever. I recorded the music because I thought it was beautiful, and here it turns out to be commercially very viable. And I was amazed. Same with this Appassionato was done out of a labor of love. It just hit the charts, first week on the charts, at number 12 with a bullet.
Oh, really? How do you think your sound has changed over the years?
It's gotten gutsier. It's more direct. It isn't as pretty. It's not as feminine.
What do you mean by feminine?
Oh, sort of light, airy, effeminate. It has more substance, and it's more direct.
How did you start playing in the upper register a lot?
I think I played the lead tenor part with Woody Herman's band.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was up above everybody else, and I sort of got used to it. And I think then when I got a quartet, too, we used to play in noisy clubs, people drinking, and I'd have to play in the upper register, it seems, to be heard as a lead voice over a rhythm section. And then again, maybe I just like it. I don't play nearly as much in the upper register as I used to.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Stan Getz. Most of your life you've been on and off the road, touring, traveling. How do you like life on the road?
Physically and emotionally, it can be wearing. But there's one thing that makes it all worthwhile, and that's that you do get up to play music in different towns for different people. So all the inconvenience you put up with is canceled out by that one main thing, the reason why you're there.
Mm-hmm. You have a family. You have married.
Well,
you
they're all grown
children.
Now.
Yeah, but when you were younger, was it hard to leave the family and go on the road?
Oh, my family life probably suffered from it, I'm sure. What could I do? It seems my life has been music. And the constant search for it has in some ways been the mainspring of my life. What can I do? Kids seem all right now. I love them, and they seem to love me.
Mm-hmm. I know a couple of years ago you had a malignant tumor in the back of your heart and you had surgery and seemed to recover from that fine. How is your health now?
It's pretty good. I still have cancer, and I have liver cancer, and I'm holding it at bay. I was supposed to have been dead a year and a half ago. But by taking these Chinese herbs and having acupuncture and moxibustion and eating a macrobiotic diet, I'm holding my own. Things going good. And I think playing music's going to keep me alive. I love to play music.
What led you to Chinese herbs and acupuncture as opposed to, the more medicinal approach?
The conventional Western medicine.
Thank
approach.
You. That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you.
Well, what turned me towards the alternative therapies was the fact that I did have the operation to remove this tumor from behind my heart. And a few months after it was done, it was growing back. And then I researched a lot, and I saw that chemo is poisoning. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And radiation is burning. And somehow I was led to these natural approaches. And it seems to keep me from buying the farm.
So do you have to get blood tests a lot and see how things are going?
Every 3 months I have it measured in what they call a magnetic resonance imaging. It's a very sophisticated form of looking inside you.
Is that the worst part when you're waiting for the test results?
No, I'm not worried. Every day is a bonus. I've led a full life. I really am not worried about getting a negative report. What happens, happens. But I certainly am going to go out kicking. And my way was fighting back with these therapies that I use. And I've helped some other people, too, that have tried using them by letting them know about it.
Has this affected your repertoire at all, the tunes that you feel like playing when you're performing?
No, I play whatever I want to, but it does affect the length of a performance. My stamina isn't what it should be, what it used to be. Musical stamina.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you good health, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was nice to talk to you. You're very bright with your questions.
Stan Getz has a new album called Appassionato, and he has a recent album called Anniversary. From Anniversary, this is I Thought About You.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Earl Hines, Louis Armstrong, Benny Goodman, Billie Holiday, Willie the Lion Smith, Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, just a few of the jazz musicians William Gottlieb photographed in the 1930s and 40s. Coming up, Gottlieb talks about the musicians he knew and the pictures he took of them. An exhibit of his pictures is touring the country. There were three recordings of Mahler's Fifth Symphony released last year alone. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us why the one conducted by Pierre Boulez is the one to hear. And film critic Stephen Schiff tells us if the new movie Dick Tracy lives up to the hype. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow, the Soviet Parliament has decided to consult the country's 15 republics before voting in September on whether or not to triple the price of bread. The plan would have been the first big step of a government reform package intended to introduce a market-based economy. John Reddy of the BBC in Moscow says that action in Parliament did not come as a surprise.
The Supreme Soviet's decision is certainly a setback for the government, but not one that it didn't expect. Its announcement last month that the price of bread would be trebled by the 1st of January, starting with a 100% increase on the 1st of July, was the spark that set off panic buying all over the Soviet Union. The official promise to compensate people for the price rise clearly hadn't been worked out properly, but the government is believed to have hoped that the first increase could be implemented by the beginning of August. The Supreme Soviet decided otherwise. It sent the government off to consult the constituent republics, many of which had said they wouldn't implement any price rises in the form proposed, and said it would look at the matter again in September.
John Reddy of the BBC. Soviet coal miners have called on the government to resign, charging it does not have their trust. The miners are expected to vote tomorrow on whether to form a new union in place of the old one that they say is controlled by the government. A car bomb packed with 200 pounds of dynamite exploded today in Medellin, Colombia, killing four people and injuring over 40 others. This attack came several hours after police announced that a suspected high-ranking drug figure was killed last night during a raid. Leslie Werpsa has this report.
The car bomb blew up at midday, a block away from a police station in the luxurious El Poblado neighborhood in Medellin. A police agent, a civilian passing by, and two men who reportedly set the bomb were killed. This is the first bomb to explode in Medellin in 2 weeks. It came hours after the police reported that Medellin cartel member Don Jairo Arias Tascon was killed last night during a raid and shootout also in Poblado. Intelligence sources have linked Arias to the murders of a justice minister, a judge, a police chief, and a governor. The police said he was in charge of hiring hitmen to carry out violent attacks for the Medellin cartel. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
In Washington, the White House has accused the government of Romania of undemocratic behavior in efforts to control demonstrators. Yesterday, the State Department condemned the violence and called on authorities to stop using force against protesters in Bucharest. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over a point to close at 2,928.22 on volume of 136 million shares. Trading was light as declining issues led advances. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Pierre Boulez is probably best known for conducting modern music, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Boulez is also a great conductor of Mahler. There's a new recording of Boulez conducting Mahler's Fifth Symphony on the Nuova Era import label that Lloyd thinks is the only version he's ever heard that solves all the problems of this complex piece.
Last year, three recordings of Mahler's Fifth Symphony were released, each by a major conductor. The Mahler Fifth isn't exactly obscure, but on disc, there hasn't been one particular outstanding version. This symphony seems to go off in all sorts of different directions. Conductors have a hard time making it cohere, catching Mahler's odd balance between heavy and light, wild desperation and joy. How does Mahler get from the opening funeral march and what he himself labeled the stormy, vehement second movement to the urbane scherzo? How convincing is the triumphant last movement after the aching nostalgia of the famous adagietto for harp and strings? Most conductors worry about tempos, and on these three recent recordings, there are some startling disparities. The adagietto played by Klaus Tennstedt and the London Philharmonic is 11 minutes long. That's over a minute longer than Christoph von Dohnányi's 10-minute version with the Cleveland Orchestra, and a minute makes a big difference in a movement so short. But that's nothing compared to the 7.5-minute version by Pierre Boulez and the BBC Symphony. Mahler says the adagietto should be sehr langsam, very slow. But Boulez phrases it so sensitively that even though it's probably faster than any other recorded performance, it seems to hover in slow motion in its own gossamer weightlessness. It's precisely this incredible lightness of being that makes this Boulez performance so extraordinary. The textures are so transparent you can hear everything, even though the recorded sound from a live 1968 concert is not exemplary, even for 1968. This buoyancy can turn every movement into a dance movement, even the funeral march. Boulez gets the superb orchestra to play with breathtaking flexibility. Moods shift radically and effortlessly on a dime. This entire performance holds together because it convinces you that it's about emotional swings, about, for instance, the way the distant military trumpet call of the opening alternates with passages of the most tender, open-hearted pathos. It's as if Mahler's longing for his childhood is measured against the grim sounds of the military barracks he lived near as a child. After the generation of Mahler's direct disciples, like Bruno Walter and Otto Klemperer, Pierre Boulez is the greatest Mahler conductor I've heard, and probably the greatest living Mahler conductor. This was not easy to discover. he's never actually made a commercial studio recording of a complete Mahler symphony. But tapes of his legendary series of Mahler performances in Cleveland, New York, and London have trickled out over the years. Boulez has the reputation of being cold, mathematical, objective. But this lilting, sensuous, insinuating, dazzlingly paced, and deeply affecting performance suggests that Boulez's detractors have been listening to too much gossip and not enough music.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Pierre Boulez conducting Mahler's Fifth Symphony on the Nuova Era label. This is Fresh Air. Even if the name William Gottlieb doesn't ring a bell, chances are you've seen his photographs, his pictures of the jazz greats of the 1930s and 40s, including Fats Waller, Pee Wee Russell, Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, and Billie Holiday, have been used again and again on album covers and book jackets and have been turned into posters and postcards. A touring exhibit of Gottlieb's photographs just opened in Philadelphia, and his pictures are collected in the book The Golden Age of Jazz. William Gottlieb wrote a weekly jazz column for the Washington Post in the late 30s. The Post wouldn't pay the overtime to send a union photographer to late-night clubs, so Gottlieb started taking pictures himself. He wrote and took pictures for jazz magazines through most of the 1940s, but in 1948 he left jazz for the more lucrative field of educational media. When he retired in 1979, he went back to his old photos.
I kept my negatives in ultimately in a shoebox, and after letting it ferment there for some 35, 40, well, actually around 45 years, I dug them out. And lo and behold, it was the beginning of a brand new career. So that today, although I'm 11 years retired, technically, I'm putting in a 40, 45-hour week.
Now, you say in your book of your photos that you would usually take only 3 or 4 shots a night.
That's right.
Well, that seems like very little. I know usually when someone from the press comes and they take photographs, right, they take 2 or 3 rolls, not 3 or 4 shots.
Right. Well, there's a good reason. I was paying for it. That's one reason. And secondly, when I went out carrying a camera, particularly a Speed Graphic or even a Rolleiflex, quite bulky, and they didn't have electronic flash then, so I had to carry the old-fashioned flash bulbs. And since I never shot with a light on my camera, which produces dull, flat lighting, I had always extensions, and if I had 4 or 5 flash bulbs, I wouldn't take 4 or 5 shots. I maybe would take 2 or 3 and use 2 or sometimes 3 bulbs on a shot to get more interesting lighting. So taking more than 2 or 3 shots was too expensive, too bulky, to a lot of things, and I learned to shoot very, very carefully. I knew the men and women, and I knew the music, and I knew not to shoot until I saw the whites of their eyes, so to speak. I'd wait, not now, 2 choruses from now, there'll be more emotion.
Yeah, you're saying you'd wait till there'd be more emotion. I think one of the special things about your photographs is that most of the ones I've seen anyways are of the musician while they're playing and at a moment when they're really wrapped up with what they're playing, and you really get a sense of the person's character through their face.
Well, I much appreciate that, because my ultimate goal, and that makes, I'm not the only one that does that, but that makes my photographs somewhat different from others that take jazz photographs, is I wasn't out just to get a nice picture, an interesting picture, but I took them as a writer would. What can I say in the picture that would augment the text? And it wasn't always when they were playing, sometimes when they were just listening to a playback or something like that. Now, the ultimate would be to capture their personality, but that's a very elusive quality, and I couldn't do it the majority of the time. So, but instead, I would feature some physical characteristic, perhaps, if it was a unique instrument they were playing, something that would add to the text.
You have photographs of Louis Armstrong from different parts
of his career.
Yeah, well, his fat part and his thin part, for one thing. His weight fluctuated all the time, and he was very conscious of this. The last time I saw him was in a dentist's office. We happened to have the same dentist, and I was putting on weight, and he immediately went into his breast pocket and pulled out a diet for me. He always had these diets to give to friends who he thought were a need. And it was unfortunately punctuated by some sort of a liquid dynamite, a laxative that would absolutely blow you apart. And that was a part of the key of his diet, so I didn't really follow it.
Mm-hmm. There are so many jazz photographs that are really smoky. You know, in most jazz photographs, there's a cigarette on the piano,
right.
Or a cigarette held in one of the keys of the horn.
That's right.
Or the musician's holding the cigarette, and there's just so many photos where the musician's in a cloud of smoke. And I think comparatively, there's very little cigarette smoke in your photographs.
In mine?
Yeah. I don't mean this as any kind of statement, like anti-cancer statement.
No.
But I just always associate jazz photographs with cigarette smoke. It's just
well, a couple of photographers made a thing of that. It was almost a trademark.
Yeah.
It makes a kind of an interesting photograph to backlight cigarette smoke, and especially if you have electronic flash, it seems to make it a little easier. But to me, you end up doing an essay on smoke and not on the person. And unless there happened to be some specific reason why I was associating cigarettes to that person, I saw no reason to include that as an element in the photograph. I'd rather show, in the case of Django Reinhardt, for example, who revolutionized guitar playing, despite the fact that his two or three fingers of his fingering hand were destroyed during a fire when he was in his caravan when he was a young man. And I made sure that mangled hand working on the strings was in evidence. That's what I had to say.
One of my favorite photos of the ones I've seen of yours is of the drummer Dave Tough in the cellar of a club,
yes,
during a break, practicing on his drum pads.
Well, Dave was an ascetic person, an intellectual, and a perfectionist. Often when he took a break, you know, in between sets of a number, instead of going out and relaxing, he would go down in the basement and practice on a practice pad, even though he was recognized by the inner circle as the best drummer of the day. So I caught him there with a practice pad, drumming in the basement, with his gaunt face giving him that ascetic look. And it wasn't prescience in my part, it was happenstance, but next to his practice pad is a glass of wine, which is what ultimately did him in, and he died rather young. But that was just a coincidence.
You have a photograph of Billie Holiday in which her head's thrown back, her eyes are closed.
Yeah.
She looks really lost in the song that she's singing.
Right.
It's a photo I think I've seen, too, on an album jacket or something.
Three albums, three covers of books. I've been told by people who just, this isn't a scientific analysis, but that this is the most widely reproduced photograph of any jazz person. I wanted to convey the anguish in her vocals,
mm-hmm,
in her vocalizing. Her music and her life is an anguished one, and I think I caught it.
What was the story behind the photograph?
She had just come out of a year's detention on some drug rap, and it may have been an unfair term that she was serving, but she came out looking physically beautiful. Often she was pudgy, but not at that time. And musically, she was at her peak. But the last time I saw her, she had gone down, degressed a great deal. And the word was that she wasn't even showing up at her engagements. But I went to cover it anyhow, and sure enough, the starting time came and went, and no Billy. And I waited a little longer, and still no Billy. So on a hunch, I went backstage to the dressing rooms, and sure enough, there she was sitting on a cot, pretty much without any clothes on, you know, trying to get ready for the date. And I helped put her together and brought her out to the microphone. And then, you know, I lost my stomach for the chore at hand. I neither wrote a review of it because she sounded awful, nor did I photograph her because she looked awful. And I didn't think that was fair. And even, I don't know if I even consciously put it on that basis. I just felt very down about the whole thing and didn't photograph her. But thank goodness I did catch her several times at her peak.
So one last thing. You started off writing about jazz, but ended up becoming much better known for the photographs you took.
Yeah, that's I can't explain it. It's just one of those things. Possibly one of the reasons I've often thought about is that people associated me, the musicians especially, with my camera. They'd see me with a camera. They wouldn't see me with a typewriter. And maybe I'm a better photographer than I am a writer. Whitney Balliet says that though I stopped taking pictures in 1948, no one has surpassed me yet. But when I've spoken to him, he let me know in a review that I'm a lousy writer. So maybe that's part of it. I don't really know.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, and thank you for having me. It's been very, very much a pleasure.
William Gottlieb's collection of photographs, Portraits from the Golden Age of Jazz, is currently on exhibit at the Free Library in Philadelphia.
I fell in love with you the first time I looked into them eyes. You have a certain little cute way of flirting with them eyes. They make me feel so happy. They make me feel so blue. I'm falling, no stalling, falling in a great big way for you. My heart is jumping, you started something with them eyes. You'd better look out, little brown eyes, if you're wise. They sparkle, they bubble, get you in a lot of trouble. Ah, baby, them eyes.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Trouble again in Romania and Bucharest. Demonstrators have been badly beaten in University Square by coal miners who have been brought into the capital city. The Archbishop of New York, John J. O'Connor, has said it may be the case that American politicians who are in favor of abortion rights would be excommunicated if they don't change their views. NPR's Cokie Roberts on the conservative movement in America now looking for new causes. And Robert Siegel talks with some students about history at a competition at the University of Maryland. He talks with three winners of a history fair.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You can't avoid the ads. You probably know that Dick Tracy, directed by the movie star Warren Beatty, opens this weekend. So, how's the movie? Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Would it be fair to refer to this movie as Howard the Dick? Oh, probably not. It's not that Dick Tracy is as awesomely terrible or as destined to flop as Howard the Duck. It's just that this movie is dead. The idea, of course, was to take Chester Gould's famous Depression-era comic and turn it into the ultimate comic book movie. And to that end, Warren Beatty and his team have designed their film in 8 primary colors, plus black and white, all of which results in some strange, almost subliminal correspondences within the movie frame. In other words, whenever you see yellow, it's always the same shade of yellow. If Tess Trueheart, Tracy's girlfriend, is wearing red, it's the same red as in the fire hydrant she's walking past, and you almost unconsciously relate the two. Tess? Fire hydrant? Does that mean Tess is dousing Tracy's romantic flame? Unfortunately, no. It doesn't mean that or anything else. It's just sort of pretty. In fact, all this color gimmickry is finally little more than a novelty. And so is the movie's design, which is blatantly artificial in the Batman manner. Lots of dark, looming cityscapes, though most of them are simpler and boxier than the Baroque geometries of Gotham City. Is this stuff evocative? Sure, but only for a while. Gradually, you realize that the design doesn't support the story. The story is there to support the design. The plot is a little nothing. It's all about how the gangster Big Boy Caprice, played by Al Pacino, is out to take over the city. And a